During the boom days of coal, places like Keystone were said to have their fair share of shootouts, card players, and red light districts. 100 years ago, characters came to McDowell County by horse or by train from all over the world. Like his first novel, The Ballad of Trenchmouth Taggart, Glenn Taylor's latest book weaves imagination, history, and tall tales into a story that feels like it was dreamed up late at night around a campfire. Taylor is a native of Huntington, West Virginia, but his father grew up in Matewan, where a lot of those stories were told, mostly by men.
I think as a kid growing up, you're always going to be around uncles and other acquaintances who make jokes about, where's such and such. Well, he's headed down to Cinder Bottom, Well, he's gone down to Keystone for the weekend, And it became clear at some age that what they were joking about were whorehouses, for lack of a better term. Houses of ill fame, if we want to sound a little more proper, because they were still going. I was born in 1975. And there are some who will tell you that you could still entertain that kind of notion all the way up through, maybe the 80s. And so I kind of heard about it as a kid. I don't think I paid much attention and, of course, was just innocent as could be, so didn't understand any of it. No, I'm just kidding. But I've heard about it for quite some time.
Will you read one of the opening scenes of your novel, A Hanging at Cinder Bottom, the one where the epic poker game is about to begin?
I would be happy to. This chapter is called Queens Full of Fours, February 17th, 1897. It was Wednesday. Snow had stuck to the mountaintop, but not the road. It was the day on which a game of stud poker commenced in Keystone that would last 13 years. It wasn't intended to last that long. It was intended instead to carry in the kind of money most couldn't tote. And it would do so in a quiet fashion, for the game itself was the only of that day's events not publicized by handbill in the growing town. You must see the lobby to believe it, the papers said. Grand opening, Alhambra Hotel. It was Henry Trent's most ambitious project to date, a 3-story brick building with 4 columns in front. He'd build it on the southwest bank of Elkhorn Creek, where the moneyed folk had moved. 5 men had been invited by courier to sit at the big stakes table. One of the 5 was Abe Baich, then 17 years of age. Having already cleaned the pockets of the men at his daddy's saloon, he had a reputation. Most had quit calling him Pretty Boy Baich in favor of the Keystone Kid. The kid whistled that stale February morning as he walked west on Bridge Street with his arm around his girl. Goldie Toothman whistled too, pressed against him tight for heat. She'd bought him a $6 gray overcoat for his birthday to match the stiff hat he wore. The coat was long, well-suited for Abe, who'd stretched to 6'2". They stopped halfway across the bridge, and though his pocket watch told him he was nearing late, Abe said he needed to spit in the creek. It was superstitious ritual, but neither of them was taking chances. They regarded the water below, rolling black over broken stones. Along the banks, it was frozen, brittle-edged and thin, and the color of rust. "I'll play quick and clean," Abe said. "I know you will." She put her hands inside his coat button spaces for warmth. She kissed him at the collarbone and told him, "Don't cross Mr. Trent." She whispered, "Keep your temper." He locked his hands around her and squeezed. "Liable to freeze out here," he said. Beneath her jacket she wore only an old gown. There had been little time for sleep the night before, and no time for proper dressing that morning. Sleep came short and ended abrupt when cards and bottles turned till sunup.
So in that scene, we meet your 2 heroes, Abe and Goldie, and they are not your traditional heroes. Can you talk about them a little bit?
Sure. A lot of times things start with a name for me. So, for instance, this last name, Baich, I just love to say it. I've always loved to say it. It is my wife Margaret's great-great-grandfather's name. He was I. Lee Baich. That stands for... There's tricky. It could be Isaac or Isaiah, but I think it's Isaiah. Isaiah Lee Baich. And he would have been born in and around Pocahontas, Virginia in the 1860s. His parents were German Jews who had come over in the 1860s, and he ended up in Kermit, West Virginia. Other than that, not much about Abe really has anything to do with the real I. Lee Baich, just the family name. My character, Abe Baich's penchant for cards and cons and things like that comes more from the type of stories that I love to hear from southern West Virginia, places like Keystone, which was so chock full of saloons, and places like Thurman, which is where the card game really did go on for roughly 13 years uninterrupted by switching in players. I had always been so interested in that. And so I kind of combined things. Goldie herself is also kind of a combination of many people. It's interesting, I just got back from Berea and the Appalachian Symposium there, as I was telling you, and we were talking about tough mountain stock women. We were talking about strong Appalachian women. And I suppose Goldie comes from knowing those type of women in my own family and just hearing about some of the madams in Keystone who wielded real power and made some pretty serious scratch, too. So it was a very interesting, progressive, and diverse place, and they came from a combination of that and family stories, I guess.
Your heroes in the novel sort of take on the rich villains who basically run Keystone. Why'd you decide to kind of pit these characters that have been taken advantage of by the millionaires, basically, and they take them on? Why'd you decide that?
I think part of it has to do with I'm a sucker, like many readers and writers, for a good underdog story. I just always have been. I think it maybe is something that is generated among those of us born and raised in West Virginia who then leave the state and you kind of have an underdog mentality, perhaps. Part of it is probably also because I'll just go ahead and say it, I've never been very good at plot. And so the long con was a way for me to kind of keep myself on track. I had them take on the powers that be in a very calculated way because that helped me calculate how to write the book. And speaking of the structure of the book, I actually had to go back in time for chapter two all the way to 1877 to show how Abe's father, Al Bache, first came to town from Baltimore, having only recently arrived in Baltimore from Germany. And so here, his first night in town, he's watching Rutherford, the embalmer and so-called chief of police, who has a terrible fear of snakes, towing a coffin out of town. At midnight, drunk, he watched Rutherford trot his horse out of town with a fresh-cut coffin in tow, the rig drawing lines in the dirt. He stood in the dark with Trent, a lantern on the ground between them. Rutherford winced at the buggy seat's unforgiving springs. He muttered about there not being enough moonlight to see. He gave a wave as he passed below the balcony veranda of a long-roofed house. The two men perched up there did not wave in return. They leaned in slant-backed chairs, their feet propped on the balustrade. They were the Beavers brothers. They liked to think that they saw everything from their high, covered domicile. Trent could see their cigar tips glowing. He watched his man pass beneath. He watched Harold Beavers lean sidewise in his chair and take something from a covered basket on the porch floor. Harold stood up, clutching a pair of writhing black rat snakes. He leaned over the rail and aimed and tossed the snakes upon the passing Rutherford. One landed on his shoulder, the other on the swell of his trail saddle. He screamed as a small child would scream, and he pulled free of his boots from their stirrups and leapt to the ground, where he clawed at the mud, pulling himself from the scene, panting in the high notes of a woman in labor. The Beavers brothers laughed as hard as they had in months, and so did Henry Trent as he watched from afar. When he'd understood what he'd seen, Al Bache followed suit, chuckling uncomfortable at what evidently passed for humor in his new environs. Rutherford stood up and drew his lengthy sidearm and shot both snakes dead where they'd slithered against the ditch wall. His horse just stood there, long since gun broke. Rutherford did not look up at the Beavers brothers where they roared, nor did he turn to regard Henry Trent. He holstered his pistol and climbed back aboard by way of an extra-long fender, and he rode off in the quarter-moon dark.
Glenn Taylor is a fiction writer, and he teaches creative writing at West Virginia University, and his new novel is called Hanging at Cinder Bottom. Glenn, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with me.
It was my pleasure.
Now the girls up Cinder Bottom, pretty and they're fat. They won't take IOU, the deal is strictly cash. Long as you keep spending, smile.